Lecture 18, Abraham Lincoln, the first Republican president.
Welcome back to the world of Abraham Lincoln. In our previous lecture, we talked about Abraham Lincoln's early life. We discussed the influences on his political thought and on his character. We examined his political career as a member of the Illinois State Legislature and as a member of Congress. We looked at his failed campaign for the Senate from Illinois in 1854 and his emergence as a leader of the Republican Party in Illinois after the Whig Party disintegrated in the mid-1850s. In this lecture, we pick up the story of Lincoln's political career with his famous campaign for the Senate from Illinois in 1858 and his debates with his Democratic opponent, his old adversary, Stephen A. Douglas. We examine Lincoln's successful campaign for president in 1860 and his approach to the early days of the Civil War. The national reputation that Lincoln made after his debates with Douglas will be highlighted as Lincoln transformed himself from a relatively obscure Illinois politician into the Republican nominee for President of the United States. The lecture will cover the dissolution of the American political system in the 1850s, the complex political alignments of 1860, and the results of Lincoln's eventual triumph in that election. But first, to the Lincoln-Douglas debates of 1858. The controversy over slavery intensified in 1856 and 1857. In the Dred Scott case, the United States Supreme Court ruled that the Constitution protected slavery everywhere in the United States. In Kansas, pro- and anti-slavery forces were engaged in a sometimes violent conflict that turned the territory into quote-unquote bleeding Kansas. Abolitionists were demanding the immediate end of slavery, while on the other hand, Southerners were defending their peculiar institution more vehemently than ever before. Southerners were not only in a defensive position now when it came to slavery, but rather they had developed, in effect, an ideology that positively viewed slavery and defended slavery as part of a broad vision for a stable, moral, religiously based American republic. In the wake of all of these conflicts, in 1858, Illinois Republicans nominated Abraham Lincoln as their candidate to oppose the re-election of Democratic Senator Stephen Douglas. At the conclusion of the Republican nominating convention in Illinois, Abraham Lincoln delivered a rousing speech that would become historically famous. It was a speech that concluded with the following declaration. Quote, "A house divided against itself cannot stand. I believe this government cannot endure permanently, half slave and half free. I do not expect the Union to be dissolved. I do not expect the house to fall, but I do expect it will cease to be divided. It will become all one thing or all the other." Unquote. Lincoln did not advocate the breakup of the Union, of course, nor did he expect it. But he did understand that the issue of slavery needed somehow, some way, to be settled finally in the United States. Even in these years before the Civil War, Lincoln recognized that the United States was a nation at war among itself, at war over this poisonous, unresolved issue of slavery. It has been argued by historian Mark Neely that with this speech, that to date was Lincoln's most extreme statement against slavery, he planted in the minds of Northerners that they were under assault from a Southern slave conspiracy. In the campaign of 1858 for Senator from Illinois, and in the series of debates that became known as the Lincoln-Douglas debates, this issue of slavery, this unresolved issue, would be at the forefront of discussion. In the Lincoln-Douglas debates, Douglass eloquently defended his idea of popular sovereignty, the right of the people in the territories to decide for themselves whether they should be slave or whether they should be free. In turn, Lincoln was equally eloquent in using the legacy of Thomas Jefferson and the Declaration of Independence to show that we had a long tradition of freedom and liberty in the United States, and that the expansion of slavery was inconsistent with that tradition. Remember, in my one of my lectures on Thomas Jefferson, I explained that despite Jefferson's own personal time-bound limitations, there was an explosive force to the Declaration of Independence, that this document would be an inspiration for struggles for freedom by peoples of all kinds throughout the centuries. And indeed, here was Abraham Lincoln drawing on the Jeffersonian tradition, drawing on the Declaration of Independence to oppose slavery, to oppose the institution that Thomas Jefferson himself had used to support his own life. The debates attracted huge crowds of 10,000 or more, and spectators were captivated. Indeed, the entire nation was captivated. And you got to remember, these were long, intricate speeches. The debates went on for hours. They were filled with the most complicated arguments, with all kinds of historical and legal references. Yet the people listened, and the people were captivated because in their gut, they knew just how critical and how important this issue of slavery was to the future of the United States. In the words of Harper's Weekly magazine, quote, "These two men, both of them of unquestionable ability, proposed to discuss the most important and fundamental political principles before the people of the state," unquote. The debates pressed Lincoln to define and develop his policy regarding slavery and to refine and develop his ideas about race. When pressed on the issue of racial equality by one audience, he remarked that, quote, "I am not, nor ever have been in favor of bringing out in any way the social and political equality of the white and black races," unquote. His position on this issue did evolve over time. But you have to remember, however much Lincoln was morally opposed to slavery, he was still a very pragmatic politician who could not afford to be too far out in front of the majority of the American people when it came to the very sensitive issue of race. In his last debate with Douglas, Lincoln reiterated in a stirring way his opposition to slavery. Quote, "The sentiment that contemplates the institution of slavery in this country as a wrong is the sentiment of the Republican Party. On the other hand, I have said there is a sentiment which treats it at not being wrong. That class will include all men who positively assert that it is right, and all who, like Judge Douglas, treat it as indifferent and do not say it is either right or wrong," unquote. So here was Lincoln laying down the challenge to Douglas and all his supporters, saying, look, you can't dodge the issue of slavery. You can't take a neutral position on this critical moral issue. If you don't say slavery is wrong, then in effect, you are in the same camp as those individuals who say that slavery is right. A very strong and advanced position for Abraham Lincoln. Lincoln did manage to beat out Douglas in the popular balloting in Illinois in 1858. But in these days, remember, U.S. senators were not chosen by popular voting, but they were chosen by the state legislature. And the state legislature gave its support to Douglas. He was reelected, and Lincoln had once again lost a race for the Senate. But in the process, he had established a national name for himself, and he had established himself as a most eloquent opponent of slavery. We now turn to the presidential election of 1860. incumbent President James Buchanan, who had been elected in 1856, would prove entirely unable to contain the long simmering sectional conflict over slavery that was bubbling into rebellion by the end of his term. The presidential election of 1860 would take place with the American political system in dissolution. With Buchanan wisely retiring from public life, his Democratic Party would splinter into Northern and Southern factions, opening the way to the election of the Republican nominee. Abraham Lincoln, in early 1860, was an undeclared candidate for that Republican nomination. And in February of 1860, he first introduced himself to a Northeastern Republican audience with a speech at Cooper Union in New York City. Here is Abraham Lincoln, you know, the guy from Illinois, coming in front of this tough New York audience. He was awkward. He was ungainly. He had unfashionable clothing. He spoke in such a low voice that at first it was very difficult to hear him at all. He spoke in a strange Midwestern accent, hardly stuff designed to impress the audience. But Abraham Lincoln won over this audience. He won them over with the simple and eloquent logic of his arguments, which dealt with the position of the founding fathers and the Constitution on the expansion of slavery. One eyewitness reported that, quote, "I forgot his clothes, his personal appearance, and his individual peculiarities. Presently forgetting myself, I was on my feet like the rest, yelling like a wild Indian, cheering this wonderful man," unquote. Quite an impression that Abraham Lincoln made on one of the toughest audiences in the United States. Lincoln's speech expressed his moral opposition to slavery and his practical opposition to the expansion of slavery. But the speech was also designed to conciliate the South and avoid a potential breach of the Union that seemed to be impending along with the upcoming presidential election. Thus, Lincoln declared, quote, "Wrong as we think slavery is, we can yet afford to let it alone where it is," unquote. And that had been his consistent position. He believed slavery was morally wrong. He, of course, in his visionary moments, believed that ultimately the nation had to come to a reckoning with the slavery issue. But he still was not willing to take the position that the federal government had the authority to interfere with slavery where it existed. And to avoid a potential breakup of the Union, he was willing to try to reassure the South on this critical point. Lincoln did indeed win the Republican nomination in 1860, and he won it as a moderate candidate, the candidate who opposed expansion but was not inclined to interfere with slavery where it existed. Lincoln became the Republican convention's compromise choice as the delegates rejected William H. Seward, the candidate of the party's more strongly anti-slavery wing. The party platform opposed the expansion of slavery, but consistent with Lincoln's views, stopped short of advocating its abolition. In addition, the platform was also consistent with Lincoln's ideas about activist government and government promotion of the economic expansion of the nation. Thus, it called for such action as homestead legislation to promote Western settlement, protective tariffs, and internal improvements. The Democrats, meanwhile, were a party in disarray. They failed to nominate, at first, their party's leading light, of course, Senator Stephen A. Douglas of Illinois. Southern delegates simply bolted the party's convention. Democrats did eventually nominate Douglas at a reconvened meeting, but the breach could not be healed. The bolting Southern Democrats nominated a pro-slavery ticket of their own, headed by James Buchanan's vice president, John Breckinridge. In addition, elements of the former Whig and American parties came together and formed a new party known as the Constitutional Union Party. This party tried to unite Northerners and Southerners by avoiding the slavery issue and focusing its campaign on support for the Union and support for the Constitution. The party nominated a former know-nothing, John Bell of Tennessee, as its presidential candidate in a bid to attract border state voters. So, you had four candidates competing for president in 1860. Lincoln, Douglas, Breckinridge, the Southern Democrat, and Bell, the Constitutional Union Party candidate. Democratic candidate Stephen Douglas recognized how difficult it would be for him to win with a divided Democratic Party, and he departed from the usual practice, and he stumped the nation on his own behalf. Otherwise, the Democratic and Republican campaigns featured the usual spectacular pageantry and popular participation characteristic of mid-19th century political campaigns, mass rallies, torchlight parades, and day-long rounds of oratory. Indeed, politics was considered part of the popular entertainment of this period. Abraham Lincoln himself, the man recognized for some of the most moving oratory in all of American history, made no campaign speeches whatever in 1860. Still, when the ballots were finally tallied, Abraham Lincoln emerged victorious. Stephen Douglas, the nominee of the previously dominant Democratic Party, finished last in the Electoral College with only 12 electoral votes. Abraham Lincoln was overwhelmingly elected in the Electoral College with 180 votes, almost all of them from the populist northern states. But despite this overwhelming Electoral College victory, he only managed to win in this four-way election 40% of the popular vote, the lowest polled by any winning presidential candidate in any election since that time. Lincoln, however, would preside over a unified Republican government. The Southern Secession of 1861 would give Republicans strong majorities in both houses of the Congress. So, just 6 years after its birth, the new Republican Party would now come to control the American government. Abraham Lincoln, elected because of the dissolution of the old political order in the United States, would now have the most difficult task of presiding over the problem of the dissolution of the nation itself. We now turn to the onset of war following Lincoln's election. Lincoln's election itself precipitated events that would lead to war. The selection of a Republican president opposed to slavery's expansion was unacceptable to many Southerners. A week after Lincoln's victory, the South Carolina legislature organized the secession convention, and in late 1860, the delegates voted for, quote, the dissolution of the Union between the state of South Carolina and other states under the name of the United States of America, unquote. By February of 1861, Lincoln would not even be inaugurated until the next month. Six other states, essentially the entire lower South, had followed South Carolina and removed themselves from the Union. So excited were the passions of this controversy that Lincoln's advisors feared for his life, and they basically had him sneak in to the nation's capital under the cover of darkness. Throughout the lower South, federal forts, armories, post offices, customs houses, and other installations were being taken over by the new state governments. President Buchanan declined to recognize the seizures as acts of war. He wasn't ready to go to war, but he also refused South Carolina's demands that federal forces be evacuated from Fort Sumter in Charleston Harbor. Even before Lincoln's inauguration, then, he was faced with the crisis of secession, and he debated his options. His first action, of course, was to appoint a cabinet that was balanced among the various factions of the Republican Party. Notable appointments included William Seward. His old opponent for the Republican nomination as Secretary of State, and Salmon Chase of Ohio as Secretary of the Treasury. He appointed as Attorney General Edward Bates of the border state of Missouri, a move calculated to show his moderate tendencies. His one great mistake was the appointment of the venal and incompetent Simon Cameron as Secretary of War. Cameron was best known for saying that an honest politician is, quote, a man who, when bought, stays bought. Well, Lincoln recognized this mistake and soon replaced Cameron with the very able Edwin M. Stanton. Lincoln tried to stop the tide of secession by declaring again that it was not his intention to interfere with slavery where it existed. But he also declared his resolve to maintain possession and control of government property in the South. By the time he took office, supplies at Fort Sumter in Charleston Harbor were running low. In early April, he ordered an expedition to resupply the garrison and so notified the governor of South Carolina, who responded with the demand that the fort surrender. But the fort's commander refused, and Sumter was bombarded early on the morning of April 12th. The Civil War had begun, and critically, the South had fired the first shots. That was something that helped Lincoln unite the North behind the war effort. Lincoln called out the militia, and the last four Southern states, including Virginia, on the border of the nation's capital, seceded from the Union. From today's perspective, it is difficult to understand the tremendous pressures on Abraham Lincoln in these early days of the Civil War. We'll now look at Lincoln's burden. First, on paper at least, Abraham Lincoln was absolutely unprepared to lead the nation into war. His only prior federal office had been a brief term in Congress. He had no military experience other than his brief and inconsequential enlistment during the Black Hawk War. He had no administrative experience of any kind. Lincoln had simply never run any major organization before, and now he was in charge of the federal government at its most perilous moment. Second, Lincoln had to balance almost impossible conflicting sentiments. In particular, he had to work to keep crucial border states such as Missouri, Kentucky, and Maryland within the Union. These were states where there was considerable pro-Southern sentiment. Yet at the same time, he had to maintain the support of liberal Republicans in the North, support that was absolutely critical to the conduct of the war. He had to placate both those who thought he was moving much too swiftly and recklessly, as well as those who thought he was not doing nearly enough to extinguish the rebellion and fight against slavery. Finally, Lincoln was operating under vast uncertainty. In the early stages of the war, he was utterly dependent upon troops recruited in and sent from the individual states. He called for the troops, and at first, none arrived. Indeed, Lincoln lamented that, quote, I don't believe there is any North, unquote. Eventually, the troops did arrive to defend the Capitol. But throughout the war, in a way that's hard to imagine in this era of modern communication and transportation, Lincoln had to deal with inadequate information, and he had to deal with inaccurate and conflicting reports from the front. It was very difficult for Lincoln to keep on top of the details of this war. We now look at some of Lincoln's early responses to war. Lincoln took decisive action to try to suppress what he believed to be not a war between nations, and this is critical, but a lawless domestic insurrection. Thus, in his view, the United States was simply fighting to restore its constitutional authority on its own territory. As commander-in-chief, and as the president who had taken an oath to, quote, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution, Lincoln assumed broad powers to put down the insurrection. He told some visitors to the White House, quote, as commander-in-chief in time of war, I suppose I have a right to take any measure which may subdue the enemy, unquote. Lincoln was devoted, you must understand, to preservation of the Union and was willing to take the steps necessary to preserve the Union. But at the same time, he was not devoted to its preservation at all costs. He was not ready to sacrifice American freedom and give in to the slave power simply to hold the Union together. The president also adopted several specific wartime measures early on. In addition to summoning the militia, he ordered a blockade of the Confederacy's ports. He expanded the regular army beyond its legal limit, and he directed government expenditures in advance of congressional appropriations. He suspended the writ of habeas corpus as well, and authorized army commanders to declare martial law in areas behind enemy lines. This suspension of this protection to protect people from being imprisoned without being charged with a specific crime aroused considerable opposition throughout the country. But Lincoln had little tolerance for opponents of this most critical war, opponents termed poisonous copperheads. Some 13,000 persons were imprisoned for anti-war activities. The most famous of those imprisoned was an Ohio Democratic politician by the name of Clement L. Vallandigham, whose name, despite its difficulty in pronouncing, became a rallying cry for Lincoln's opponents and opponents of the war, and there were many. Lincoln, during the war, continued martial law behind the lines, although he did try whenever possible to avoid arbitrary arrests and to avoid any attempts to suppress newspapers or to suppress popular assemblies on the part of the people. After the war, the Supreme Court would rule that a president cannot authorize the court-martial of civilians in places where the civil courts were still open. But that, of course, came later. In the meantime, from Abraham Lincoln's perspective, he and the nation had moved into a position of total war for the defense of the Union, and total war for the defense of the principles upon which he believed the Union was founded. He would come to settle for nothing less than unconditional surrender by the Confederacy. Indeed, his view was that there was no Confederacy, but only a band of lawless rebels who must be suppressed by lawful constitutional power. He hearkened back to President George Washington, who you remember from a previous lecture had suppressed the insurrectionary farmers during the Whiskey Rebellion of the 1790s. He had suppressed the Whiskey Rebellion with overwhelming force because he wanted to show nations all over the world that America was a strong union. And, of course, he wanted to show the people at home that the federal government was prepared to take whatever steps were necessary to preserve the Union. That was the same position that Abraham Lincoln took with respect to the much greater peril of the Civil War. The war also forced Abraham Lincoln to make other changes in national policy. In just a couple of years, the American government and the relationship between the government and the people and the government and the economy was fundamentally transformed. To finance the war effort, the federal government issued paper money for the first time since 1789 was not secured by gold, silver, or bonds. To finance the war, the administration instituted a graduated income tax and established a uniform national banking system. When voluntary enlistments and even bounty payments failed to raise enough soldiers, Congress established a nationwide draft in March of 1863. By this time, already many tens of thousands of Union troops had been lost in this most bloody war to death, injury, and desertion. In our next lecture, we'll pick up on the actual course of the Civil War, describe some of the early battles of the war, and look at the great disappointment that Lincoln faced in those early months of the war as his generals seemed to be outmaneuvered by the commanders of the Southern forces.